You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are talking
while married.
Well, you know, the one thing I like is when you make Mexican coffee.
I know, isn't it good?
You know, every time when I just smell it, right? But I mean, smelling it is enough. But tasting it, it just reminds me of when we go to Mexico.
Well, I thought that because of this storm that we've just been through, that just the Mexican coffee would be kind of warming and nice to have tonight.
Oh, man, I love the sound of rolling thunder, but it scares the dogs.
Yep, it does.
But you know, this morning waking up to a absolutely cloudless, glorious Texas spring day has just been fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a great day. It's been a great day. So I want to know, you know, let's see what you have to talk about tonight, because I'm in a talky mood.
Well, I've got all sorts of things to talk about, but, you know, forensically speaking, I'm just mesmerized by the recent arrest of that serial killer from California, you know, the Golden State Killer.
I remember when that was going on.
Yeah, well, we were both new on the job, right? And the guy's name was, you know, Joseph James DeAngelo. And they got this guy after 40 years by a DNA site. Okay, you know, like, 23andMe and these different sites that we see on, you know, genealogy.com and, you know, all these different genealogical DNA sites, figure out who you are and where you're from. And apparently this guy used a site that I think was called GED Match.
Right, exactly. Okay? That's what I heard, yeah.
And apparently they managed to match up his DNA. I think they went into his garbage. And they pulled some samples from his garbage, and they put this whole thing together. Isn't that absolutely amazing?
Well, wasn't it? It was one of his relatives that had done the GED match, right? And his samples, the samples from the crime scenes, matched enough of that person that it just raised all kinds of red flags. So then they went and said, okay, who could be related? And here was the guy, and they went and got his samples, and there you go. I mean, just fantastic police work.
Well, you know, and it just proves that in most cases, it's not a matter of if we get you, it's when we get you.
Yeah.
And, you know, DeAngelo, you know, just absolutely terrorized the San Francisco Bay Area, Santa Barbara County, Orange County, you know, for a 10-year period between, you know, the mid-70s and the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, he's off the radar screen, right? And no more leads, no nothing, and the trail grows cold. So I was just very happy that law enforcement was able to put this thing together.
Right. It was an investigator by the name of last name of Schubert who put together a task force and got this done. So I do think it's amazing. I distinctly remember this killer being out there, and I remember the fear. I remember my mom, my sisters, and so forth, and I remember the fear that people had over this one. And there was another one at the same time that was out there.
Well, the Zodiac Killer. I don't know if you if that's the one you're referring to.
Well, anyway, that this one I know was the thing about this one that was so creepy was that he used to put teacups on the back of the so he'd go in a bedroom and there'd be a man and woman asleep, and he would grab the woman, but on the man's back he would put teacups so that if he heard those teacups rattle, he said that he would kill the wife.
Wow, you know, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. You know, but one thing I do know about this guy, Mr. DeAngelo, was that he was a former police officer. I think he got fired, and he was a police officer up in the Central Valley of California, you know. So, boy, I'd sure like to get into that guy's mind and figure out what he was thinking and why he killed all those people. Just absolutely tragic.
So, I have some interesting trivia, useless trivia for you, of course.
Okay, go with it.
Okay, so speaking of DNA, you know, my sisters recently got DNA done, and You know, I haven't done it, and I'm pretty sure you haven't either.
That's because I know who I am, and I know where I'm from.
Okay. Well, I don't feel a need to do it. I'm like you. I kind of feel like, you know, I am who I am, and nothing that that says is going to change it. But anyway, are you enjoying that coffee?
I'm going to spill it anyway, on my shirt. That's what I did.
So what I learned about the DNA that's so interesting to me is that, it's, for example, in my family, there's four girls and a boy. And if we all did our DNA, it would come out, our ethnicity would come out a bit different one from the other. Now,
really?
How could that possibly happen?
That was my question.
Okay.
So what's the answer?
Well, when that egg and sperm get together, you receive the genetics from your parents. And for example, you know, maybe like my sister has brown hair and I have blonde hair. Some of us have blue eyes, some have green eyes, that type of thing. Well, you pull more from one parent or the other depending on, you know, whatever, however the cards fall at that time.
You know, something tells me we need our microbiologist daughter here to explain this to me.
She could probably explain it. Well, but I'm going to put it in simple terms for you,
okay,
honey.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let's just say that my mom is from Holland, which she is, and let's say that my dad is from Italy. And so my sister and I could have more Dutch in me and she could have more Italian in her when they do the ethnicity if we both had the same test. And it's just the way that your genetics pull. I just assumed that we all would be the same, but that's not so.
Well, see, that's what I would assume too. So
yeah.
This is really interesting you're bringing us up.
Yeah, I just randomly found it by, you know, kind of studying a little bit about the whole DNA thing. Based on this crime case that we're talking about, I thought it was an interesting subject. So anyway, that's my useless bit of trivia for the day.
Well, you know, wow, you just bring up a conundrum for a lot of people, right? Because there's so many commercials on the television, right? And, you know, 23andMe and, you know, all these different DNA companies that are advertising on television and people think they're one thing and then all of a sudden, you know, they end up being something completely different,
yeah,
right?
So that's true.
So their narrative of their life story changes dramatically.
Right. Well, that actually happened in our family as well. And I'm not going to, you know, talk about that again right now because we already know, but that absolutely
it's
lots
okay.
and lots
you
of
can,
people.
You can admit you're not Italian, okay? You can admit that.
lots of people, you know, do find that they're different than they thought. Although I am not sure why that should be life changing. It wouldn't be for me, but you know, however it is, it's an interesting subject. And the thing also that's so interesting to me about the DNA is that now that law enforcement can go into DNA sites like 23andMe and be able to subpoena DNA. And so let's take this to its logical conclusion, which is what happened in this case, that they can go into these sites and they can get matches on DNA that they may have on file for, say, a murderer or a case that happened. And they can now get a relative that has close DNA, and then they can start subpoenaing and then look at those relatives.
Yeah, but before we freak each other out here, we actually know that they need probable cause to do that, right?
Oh, sure,
and they
got
to get a warrant, right? So there's got to be a warrant to open up that database. But they can do it, and that's the bottom line.
Well, it does have to remind us both, that everything that you do or you think that you're doing privately doesn't necessarily stay private. So
no,
it's always something to remember.
Absolutely. I think that is important.
Yeah. So, okay.
Well, what's your next subject?
Well, I had a little bit of a interesting thought about this whole thing that's happening with Ben Carson and the low-income Americans that he wants to propose getting their rent raised.
Because he's our Secretary of Human Urban Development, right?
Right.
Our Health and Human Services,
Health and
I
Human
guess.
Services, yeah.
There you go.
So he wants to raise the rent, and the outcry is that he's tripling people's low-income rent. And that would be from $50 a month to $150 a month.
And that's for what we call Section 8 housing, right?
Right.
Okay.
And this is really reasonable to me. And it seems like that we can't, you know, we are in a time right now where unemployment is very, very low. The lowest it has been, I think, since, what, the 70s?
Absolutely.
So there are jobs out there. And there are people that absolutely need these social services to help them exist. They could be elderly people. They could be people that have handicaps of some sort.
Sure.
But there certainly are, let's be real, people that are taking advantage of the system. And people that can do some work in order to, you know, kind of earn their way in life, too. And also, I just feel like it helps people move on the path forward in life.
No, you know, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, the state of Maine is a wonderful example of that when you're talking about bootstrapping up and becoming independent. And you got to give people sometimes, I mean, the bottom line is you just got to give them a shove. Okay, because they'll get
a little nudge.
Well, you do, because they get into that malaise, and then, you know, they've got the whole entitlement thing, and you just got to remove that. I mean, you know, you've got to give people, you got to believe in people. And, you know, I'll go beyond that. You got to get people to believe in themselves, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in Maine, back in 2014, the state of Maine changed the paradigm with regards to entitlement subsidies, and specifically food stamps, right? So they require, since 2014, they now require all able-bodied men and women without kids to go to work in order to get food stamp subsidies, right? And so there's three criteria for this. Okay, number one, you got to be able to find work. Number two, you got to be able to participate in a work training program. And number three, if you can't do that, you got to be able to do community service.
Right, so it's one of the three you have to do, right?
Yeah, you got to do one of the three.
You have to find work or yeah.
But let me tell you what happened in Maine, because it's absolutely an example for all the other states we have in the United States, and especially, you know, our old homestead back in horrible California. But within 3 months, the state of Maine reduced their caseload of people on food stamps and other entitlements by 80%. That is absolutely astounding.
That is astounding.
So, you know, if you take a look at that, and by the way, if they balked at any of those things, right, the three criteria, if they said, well, I'm not going to find work, or I'm not going to be in a training program, or I'm not going to do community service, all of those food stamp subsidies went away. Okay, so they reduced their caseload by 80%, which means that now they gave those people a little nudge, and 80% of those people within 3 months went off the rolls, right? So
right.
That shows me that there were a lot of people that were malingering that needed a little kick in the shorts to get them going. But, you know, it's not just that kick of the shorts. It's exactly what we said. They started to believe in themselves, okay? And it starts with those work training programs. But I want to talk to you about how the money was wasted at the same time.
Okay.
And I didn't even know this, but people that buy cigarettes, you can actually use food stamps for cigarettes. And I didn't know that. I thought you couldn't use food stamps for alcohol, and you couldn't use it for, you know, for cigarettes and in candy and stuff, you know, that you don't need, not supplements, right? But anyway, they found that 50% of the people that they had on their food stamp case rolls smoked. And that amounted to $111 a month. And I was doing a little research. And if you were in New York City, which has a tremendous entitlement program, the taxpayers in New York City are subsidizing smokers to the tune of over $3,200 a year. My God, that's taxpayers per person paying $3,200 a year so those people can smoke cigarettes.
And that's double what the rent is at the $150 a month.
Yeah.
Just for cigarettes.
So you got to put it in perspective. And, you know, I think Dr. Carson is a fabulous man. He's got a wonderful life story. And, I mean, kudos for him for doing this type of thing.
Well, I agree. And I do think that it's – that every time that we have – taken subsidies away from people, their lives have actually gotten better. And that's been proven in history over and over and over again. So I think that he's got – and by the way, he came from an extremely poor background.
Well, that's what I'm talking. His life story is absolutely amazing.
And he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and good parenting by his mom, and he succeeded just beyond anybody's imagination. And these people – you know, just people in general, I think, Ron – we all, myself included, we have a tendency that when we are given something, we have no motivation to go out and get it ourselves. And that's just true of human nature, I think. So if we can give those people the nudge that we're talking about by taking some of these subsidies away. By the way, the food stamp subsidies were doubled under President Obama.
That's right. They went up 49%, and they were doubled by 16 million people. I mean, 16 million people? That's absolutely incredible.
Well, and that's just the double. So we're in the 30s million
right.
people here that are on food stamps. And now, and the excuse at that time was, well, everybody needs it because the economy is so bad, right?
No.
But the economy is not bad right now. The economy is booming right now. There are jobs that are going unfilled right now. We need workers. We're hiring teenagers to do work because we don't have enough adults. So there's work out there if they want it.
You know, recently we were in Washington, D.C., and I got to pick up one of the big newspapers, right? A couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
One was the Washington Post, and the other one was the Wall Street Journal. And just for fun, I went to the classified ads to see how many jobs were available.
Mm-hmm.
There were tons of jobs available, right? It's just that we've got to get people motivated to get into those jobs. And some of those jobs are lower paying jobs, okay. But you've got to start somewhere and get your confidence back, right? And then it's the belief. Can I bring up one more thing?
Sure.
Because you talked about moms, and I read something about single women you know, recently, single moms is what I mean, raising kids. And you know, you've been a single mom yourself at
mm-hmm.
one time, right? And so what they found was that, and I know you've been a strict mom, okay? And that's been a good thing, okay?
Probably not strict enough.
Well, you know, it's like tough love, right? And I'm there with you. I got your back, sister. Okay, but here's the thing. What they said about strict moms that are raising their kids, especially daughters, they found that 49% of the kids that get raised by single strict moms, they end up doing fine. They get employment. They've got self-confidence. There is a far lower pregnancy rate of girls that are raised by strict single moms than by married moms.
Really?
Okay. It's absolutely amazing. So, you know, I just a little useless trivia that I thought I'd throw out there.
Well, you know, just speaking of useless trivia again, so Ben Carson, who we were just talking about, Ben Carson has an office there at HUD, and he has a dining room table, and that dining room table is pretty bad, in bad shape. So he puts in a request for a new table, and as he does, it's $31,000, and the request gets approved. Now, I don't think that he asked for a certain amount. He just asked for the table. And so he gets the amount approved, and the whole hubbub comes out about how much money he's spending on a table. So he ends up canceling the table.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, $31,000 for a table is a lot of money for a table. It must have been a big, huge table.
It must have been a big table. I don't know. My point is that when you take somebody like Janet Napolitano in the UC system in California.
And she's the chancellor there, right?
Right.
I think she's the head of the whole system.
She's the head of the whole system, right?
Yep.
Who has been shown to be hiding $175 million of taxpayer money.
Are you kidding me?
For her slush fund that she uses to help illegal alien students and for parties and different things.
That's ridiculous.
So $31,000 against $175 million.
I get your point.
Yeah.
I get your point.
No contest.
Well, that's a good comment to make. And I'll tell you what, I had no idea that Napolitano was doing something like that. But, you know, your point's well made. But I think it's all part of the whole thing. You know, he's part of, you know, Trump's cabinet, and it's the whole Resist Trump movement, and they try to throw as much mud on everybody associated with that administration as they can. It seems like just nobody can get a break.
They
you know,
can't.
Betsy
can't.
Foss from the Department of Education, you know, I mean, all these guys. So that's absolutely amazing, and I'm glad you brought it to light.
The Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Tired of watching the same old sporting events?
Well, kick it up a notch and get ready, America, for something you've never seen before. It's the new generation of Western superstars. Shorty Gorham's American freestyle bullfighting. Who will win? The acrobatic, tough-as-nails Western superstar or the meanest half-ton fighting bulls on earth? This is one of the most extreme sports you'll ever see in an arena. This is hand-to-horn combat on a level playing field. Go to ShortyGorhamAFB.com or find them on Facebook. It's bullfighting time.
Well, did you notice I put a little bit of Kahlua in your Mexican coffee this time?
Oh, I love it when you do that.
I thought it would add a little spark to the conversation.
You know, what I want you to do one of these times is make me one of those nutty Irishmen.
Oh, yeah, those are good.
You remember that?
Oh, I do, yeah.
Oh, my God, that was... We were in Aruba, remember?
Yeah, I'll have
remember?
To figure out how to do that. Okay.
Okay. Hey, so listen, I want to talk about something unfortunate. It's just a tragedy, and it's this continuing gun violence that is going on in the city of Chicago. And most of it is in the south side of Chicago. And you know, we love the city of Chicago. Phenomenal architecture, probably one of the best architecture cities in the world, and I'm a nut for architecture.
Riverboat cruises, good food.
Good food, we're both foodies, and the Miracle Mile, right?
Yep.
Michigan Avenue,
yep,
right?
Love it.
Well, that's not where the violence is taking place,
okay.
But it's taking place primarily in the South Side of Chicago. But you know what? They've already had 158 homicides in that town, of which 129 are people that have been murdered by firearms.
This year already?
This year already,
wow.
And 664 people that have been
shot.
Oh,
my gosh, that's a lot of people.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's just this continuing saga of bad guys with guns out there. And, you know, we went through this last year. And last year, I believe, was the year that was the highest year of gun violence ever, okay, where they nearly broke 1,000. Okay, 1,000 people getting killed in the city. And, you know, it's not the most violent city in the United States, but I think it's the second most. I think Baltimore is the most per capita violent city. But the police just seem, you know, like powerless to do anything.
Well, why do you think that is? Because, I mean, personally, I think it stems from the top, Rahm Emanuel. I don't think he's helped this. I think he's absolutely hurt this situation there. But what do you think? Because, I mean, that's your thing that you do.
Well, shooting's what I do. And, you know, I did a little work up on Mayor Emanuel. And since he's been in office, they've already had 3,600 people murdered.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot
okay?
of people.
Okay. And, you know, just picture this for a second. To put it in context, sweetheart, there is a person that gets shot in the city of Chicago every 3 hours and 48 minutes, and a person that is murdered, okay, by a handgun or a firearm every 18 hours. And by the way, Chicago has besides the District of Columbia, it has the highest, most serious, and the most gun laws, okay, most restrictive gun laws in the United States outside of the, you know, Washington, D.C. But it is, as you know, it's a behavior issue and not a firearms issue, because the firearm just happens to be the implement or the mechanism of injury. But, you know, this past month we had a guy run nuts around Beijing and killed 26 people with a knife, if you can imagine that, okay? It's like the gladiatorial games.
Yeah.
He killed 26 people with a knife before they took this guy out. And, you know, last year during Bastille Day in Paris, we had that guy steal that garbage truck, that terrorist, and he killed 82 people by running them over with a garbage truck, right?
Right. And there's some areas of the UK right now that are really, like – a war zone with people being stabbed
More stabbing.
So they also have restrictive gun laws there. So people are using knives, and they actually also use acid and different things. So, I mean, it is whatever. If somebody wants to hurt somebody, they're going to do it. But in Chicago, it's interesting that this has not been something that they've been able to get under control. And this has to stem from the top, because leaders lead from the front, and I'm just not seeing that there.
Well, here's what's going on. You know, from what I look at, they have one of the worst criminal justice systems in the United States there, because these guys that are killing people, and, you know, of course, I have to do the workups on them, right? I have to look at their criminal histories and all of that stuff when I get these shooting cases. And I will tell you, categorically, these guys all fall within the same profile. They've been arrested time and time again for a gun-related crime, a gun violence-related crime, or some other aggravated assault, robbery, all these different things, and not much happens to these people. So the cops can go out there and they can do their stop and frisk. And by the way, Mayor Emanuel is just like Bill de Blasio in New York City, basically handcuffing the police, right, with respect to stop and frisk. So he's really curtailed a lot of that. So the cops are, you know, bad morale.
And okay? And that's so foolish, because that's one of the best tools that we have ever had in the department is field interrogations and
FI cards, right? and stop and frisk with probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And they've removed a lot of that. They've got a lot of ridiculous oversight with the Chicago Police Department, and the guys are, you know, sort of losing hope. And when they don't go into these high crime rate, areas of that city, and Southside Chicago is certainly one of them, okay, and they're not stopping and frisking these people, or when they do, the criminal justice system, these ridiculous judges let these guys go. Like overnight, you catch the guy with the gun, it's supposed to be a serious crime in Chicago, and they let that guy go the next day. And, I mean, you know, what are these poor police officers supposed to do? And I'll tell you what, 72% of all of the homicides in Chicago is black-on-black crime, okay?
And they're young people. Most of them are young people, and it's our youth that are getting killed. But again, it stems from the top, and if you don't get control over in Chicago, if I recall, don't they have a civilian board that looks at everything that happens with the police?
Yeah, they do.
Okay, and you have people that are not doing that job every day, day in and day out, and being on the street and just being that beat cop that really is the guy that is down in the trenches with the people and knows what's going on. They're second guessing every single thing these officers do,
right,
and it demoralizes them.
And they don't have the context, because they don't do the job. These are essentially political appointments. But, you know, just so that you don't get the wrong idea, and you know me pretty well, I feel so bad for these people in the black community. You know, 19% of these homicides are in the Hispanic community. But I feel so bad for these inner city communities, these depressed inner city communities, because these people are actually hostages in their home, of which the vast, vast majority of the people that live in these neighborhoods are just like you and me. They're good, hardworking people. They're single moms with kids. You know, maybe they're forced to be stay-at-home moms, right? And they just need a break from this violence. But the criminal justice, the cops are doing their job, but the criminal justice system is not reciprocating in getting these people off the street.
Well, so, and these kids,
I'm just going to say, you know, I hate these rallies and all these false narratives that the gun is the bad guy in this equation. It just really bothers me, because it is a behavioral issue. And if you don't mitigate the behavior, honey, if you don't put these people away that commit these crimes, these predators in these communities, you are just going to have the crime rate growing right through the roof, and that's what's going on in Chicago.
Well, they've got to get a handle on the gang situation there, because a lot of these are gang shootings, and when they are, they don't always hit the gang member that they intend to hit. And that's where you have women and children and innocent people get killed. And this is not fair, as you said, to the entire community. I mean, can you imagine? just living in a community like that where you're trying to get by, you're trying to raise your kids are being recruited into these gangs, and they almost don't have a choice of going into the gang or not going into the gang, because if you don't, then there's going to be repercussions. So they really have to get a handle on this whole gang situation there and really crack down on it and give these people some hope so that they can move forward in life.
Yeah, and you know, in Chicago is a microcosm of what we see all around the United States. You know, I recently wrote an article that you read, and I appreciate you editing it for me. you know, when I pointed out the 15 most violent cities in the United States, and of course, Baltimore was one. And you know what? Going back to California, we're originally from Little Salinas, California, which is in northern Monterey County. They had, this past year, they had 151% increase in their homicide rate. Okay, this is a town that's got, like, I don't know, 140,000 people
in
this town.
It's a little sleepy
town. It is. Yeah. It used to be. It's an agricultural town, basically. It still is. And, you know, it's become a suburb of Silicon Valley, right? People have to, you know, commute a couple of hours to get there because that's what the housing problem is there up in Silicon Valley. But, you know, you're living in this once sleepy little town, but it's completely gang and drug infested, and they get these tremendous gang violence and gun crimes in this little town, and the police are just overwhelmed.
Didn't they have, I believe that they are having an issue with the MS-13 gangs coming in there and causing all these problems. So, yeah, I mean, the gang problem, listen, it's been around for as long as I can remember, certainly as long as my lifetime. But there are things that can be done in the communities to make it better, and that's what we need to do.
Well, I think you've got something that you want to talk about with regards to the students and the Second Amendment, right?
Well, actually, you know how all the students walk out of the schools recently because they are protesting the Second Amendment, right? And they want more gun control and more restrictions and so forth.
Right. They had that big rally in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Right?
Well, now the students are doing the opposite. So now we have students walking out in support of the Second Amendment. And, you know, it's kind of heartening for me to see that these students actually understand that our Second Amendment is a very, very important right for us as Americans. It is part of the Bill of Rights. It should not change. And they also seem to understand that there's a responsibility that goes with owning a gun. And, you know, so we can have both. We can have our Second Amendment, and we can understand the responsibilities of what and when to use that firearm.
Right. And it's exactly right. And again, I go back to the behavior issue, and the only way that you're going to protect society is that you enforce the laws with respect to guns, and you enforce the laws to intervene and mitigate bad behavior and also mental health problems. And none of these people should be having guns. Felons should never have guns. People with mental health issues should never have guns. Violent people should never have guns. People that beat each other up, and domestic violence people, and child abuse people, and elderly abuse people shouldn't have guns.
But that's where the justice system has to come in and do their job. Okay, they have to take those guns from the people. And you have a perfect example here. So you remember the young man in the Waffle House who had mental health issues, and his firearms were rightfully taken away from him by a judge.
I remember that.
Okay, and the police came and confiscated them.
Right.
And the father asked for those guns to be put in his custody and signed a document that he would not give those guns back to the boy. And he did.
Yes, and I know. And then he took
four people's lives.
With the gun.
Right. So the laws are there, Ron, and we need to follow the laws. So everybody did everything right there except for that father who gave the guns back. But I'm just saying that there's so many cases where people do have mental health issues or should not have firearms, and they are still allowed to have them, and they need to be taken away.
Well, you know, we've got plenty of laws on the books. You know, hey, look, all the cops know this, okay? Anybody that's ever been a police officer knows this. We've got a million laws on the books. But unless those laws and those checks and balances are enforced and monitored, none of this is of any good. Okay, just like the guy that shot up our church in Sutherland, that shot up the Baptist church right. in Sutherland, killed 22 people, most of which were
so
little
sad.
Tiny kids. Okay, and this is a guy that, remember, had been in the Air Force and had threatened to kill his commanding officers and supervisors before. They catch this guy with guns.
Had threatened his wife.
And beaten, well, not only right. threatened his wife, he beat his wife right. and fractured the skull of his little toddler, mm-hmm. okay, and was tossed out of the Air Force on felonies. None of those felonies were reported to, you know, the National Crime Information Center at NCIC. So this guy is able to go out. He's able to buy guns and mow people down. Okay, so this is just another time where, you know, we let the public down. Okay,
right.
Our systems, our
the
government
laws were
let
there,
us down.
But somebody didn't do the reporting that needed to be done. You know, there's another kind of issue about first responders. So with first responders, talking now on the fire side of first okay. responders.
And we got our boy is a firefighter paramedic.
Is a firefighter paramedic.
So proud of that kid.
And one of the things that we talk about with him is, you know, all of the calls that they get for people that are chronically ill people.
Right, because he complains about it.
The same people call over and over again, and they transport them, which they're required to do. And the complaint is not that we're taking people to the hospital when they need to go. The complaint is, boy, if somebody is in a car accident or a motorcycle accident or has a very, very serious heart attack or something, that ambulance or that fire truck is now transporting somebody for something non-life-threatening. That becomes a problem everywhere in every department. So,
well, because they don't have the resources, okay? And
right.
when they're dealing with, you know, the chronically ill people, and a lot of these people, according to our son and other firefighters that I've spoken with, they're not that ill at all where they can't transport themselves to the hospital or can't get a friend to transport them to the hospital. So they use the emergency services more like a taxi. Now, listen, nobody's got a problem, and our boy doesn't have a problem, and none of the other firefighters I know have a problem when someone's ill to take them to the hospital because that's their job.
Exactly.
Okay? But they just don't want to be a taxi service and be transporting someone that could easily transport themselves. And then now you've got a major injury accident and you've got people that really need their help and they can't be there because they're involved in a non-essential transportation.
Right. And this is not going to change because you and I have spent a little bit of time looking into it to see that this is not going to change within the cities. However, we have a city in Wisconsin that has really made a change on their own to do this. So they did a survey and they found out that 7% of the 63,000 calls that they get for emergency service are, which is about 4,300 calls, came from
calls.
The same 100 people.
Wow.
So 4,300 calls a year came from the same 100 people over and over again. So they, instead of, you know, crying about it, they thought of a way to handle it. They hired 34 paramedics to assess the health and homes of the patients so that they can use preventative care and guidance instead of having these people calling the 911 line and getting transportation all the time. And what they found is that in the trial period of this program, they had a 26% decline in emergency calls from chronically ill patients. And in 2016, those calls dropped by 56%.
That's amazing.
And in 2017, by 62%. So that is such a good story for me to hear, because that enables people that really, really need emergency care, life-saving emergency care, to have access to those firefighters and paramedics in a much more timely fashion. And also the people that are chronically ill are getting better care.
And you know what I like about that is that these are people in the fire service that are thinking outside the box. And that's what we have to do as first responders. Just got to think outside that box. Hey, are you ready for a little filler?
One more filler.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Okay, so I've got a funny story.
Okay, like right. Funny.
Well, it just so happens, you know, Governor Jerry Moonbeam Brown.
Yes.
Our old buddy from California that we escaped from. And he's got a beautiful governor's mansion. It's just gorgeous in the center of the city, within walking distance of the Capitol in Sacramento. And he's a big sanctuary state guy, never build walls, open borders advocate. Well, the other night, a guy breaks into his house, okay, breaks into the governor's mansion. Now, why there's not protection at the governor's
mansion.
Yeah,
where's the security for this?
I don't know. Maybe they're out having a cup of coffee like us, okay? But anyway, so the guy breaks a window in a side door and goes in the governor's mansion. And, of course, the security is alerted because there are alarm systems and stuff like that. And they immediately respond and they arrest him, okay? And he's a tweaker, okay? So he's a big meth head and he's freaked out. He's under the influence of meth and he's all delusional and he's, hallucinating. And he's paranoid, right? And so he says to the cops, hey, I broke in because I thought the cats were going to attack Governor Brown. Cats, you know, mad cats going to attack Governor Brown. And they said, well, why did you think that you could come into the governor's residence? And the guy says, well, I know he's an open borders kind of guy,
and
open doors kind of guy. So I thought he wouldn't mind at all.
I wonder how Governor Brown took that because, yeah.
So what do you think? He starts building a wall around the governor's mansion right away.
I don't know,
away,
but
huh?
that's how we felt in California was, you know, with the open border, the whole open border thing, you know. We need the wall, and
so
maybe he better think about one for himself,
yeah,
too,
so
at this point if his security is letting people in.
Yeah, so shout out to Governor Moonbeam. Hey, why do we have a wall, or why do we need a wall around our company, our country? Hey, Jerry, it's to keep the bad guys out, okay? So anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you.
Well, you know, I don't know did you say that guy, was he a homeless guy?
Yeah, he was a homeless meth head, okay.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, you know, I have some my little good news stories about homeless people.
I want to hear them.
And, you know, there are people that are actually making a difference in life about the homeless problems. And because the homeless problem is just so explosive right now, and I'm not totally convinced it should be because there are jobs and things, but people make choices in life, and that's kind of the way it is. And some people don't have a choice, but some people do have
a
choice.
Some of them don't have a choice, and, you know, mental health problems and, you know, single women with kids. And, I mean, there's just a lot of problems.
There's a lot of different issues there.
Yes, you're right. A lot more of those people can absolutely pull themselves on their bootstraps and then get employed and everything. So you're right.
Well, in San Francisco, the land of tech companies, right?
Of course.
It's very, very expensive to live there.
Most expensive place in the United States.
Oh, okay. Well, that's why it's expensive to live there. So there's a formerly homeless poet and writer, Del C. Moore, who founded an organization called Code Tenderloin. And that's a nonprofit organization that wants to rehabilitate, train train and find employment for the disenfranchised residents of that Tenderloin area of San Francisco.
Sure. And it's right downtown near Market Street. That's where the Tenderloin is.
Okay. So 300 students have graduated from this program, and a third of them have been already found employment in the tech center, which is really amazing. So when you think of homeless people, you don't kind of relate that to tech people. But they are. So these are not stupid people by any means, because I don't know if I could go work in a tech job. But anyway, some of these graduates have been hired into six-figure jobs.
Oh, that's amazing.
Going from homeless to six-figure jobs. So it is quite amazing.
And it shows it can be done.
Right. It shows that it can be done. And that the directors, Victoria Westbrook, she gave some background on herself and the organization. She said that for 20 years she was a drug user who was living in a halfway house. And then her friend told her about Code Tenderloin, and she learned new skills, built business relationships, and, you know, got herself back on her feet and is working in this program. And she said that they do accept everybody in the program unless they're an active addict. And even then, they'll help them get some help to get back on their feet. So they help them with, networking, resume building, elevator pitches, all these different ways for them getting a job. So I just want to say kudos to that organization, because there are people out there, good people, that are helping homeless people. And here's another one.
Well, let's hear it.
So in San Diego, and I love these because these are kids. These are kids that are doing things that are important. There's a young man by the name of Kevin Barber, and he's 16 years old. And he instigated this program called Wheels for Change. And it was a pilot program that launched in San Diego. And it paid – it's kind of like the one you and I talked about the other night when we were talking, that this one pays people $11.50 an hour to perform tasks, labor tasks.
That was one of the cities that was doing that.
Well,
sure.
But this is his program. So picking up trash, erasing graffiti, could be working on landscaping, whatever it is that is needed. And so he brought this to San Diego, and it's really helping people get off, they get a paycheck, they're able to buy food. He asked the city to give this a trial run, and his mom actually bankrolled this. So, this is a family that really, put some time and effort into helping homeless people. And now the program, for several days a week, a van will pick them up, and they'll take them to work, and they can do whatever job that they have to do that day, and then they'll be driven back and compensated for their work. And they can also get advice and help on, getting connected with social services to help them get out of their situation and so forth. So this is a win-win for the city and the homeless and the community, and I think that's another great success story by somebody who's 16 years old. And, really just gives you a lot of hope.
You see so many kids that are out there, teenagers and things like that, and they just kind of seem lost. And, they don't know what they're going to do in their future. They're not doing a lot of planning. And so it's so wonderful and uplifting to see that you get a 16-year-old kid that is smart enough to have some direction and to want to do something, some give back for the community. And God knows that the city of, San Diego, like Los Angeles, like a lot of these, like San Francisco, they have just a huge homeless population. And anything that can put a dent in that and give some people some hope and some job skills and some money in their pocket so that they can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and move on with life, man, I applaud that young man.
Yeah, and I think that everybody has to have a goal in life to work towards. And goals give people, reasons to get up in the morning. And that goes for that young man, and it goes for the homeless people as well. So it's good all the way around. And one more kind of homeless story. There's this little young man in Birmingham, Alabama, and he's 4 years old, and his name is Austin Perrine, and he's just a little guy, and he was he likes his nickname. They call him President Austin. So he was watching a TV show about panda bears, and the mama panda bear abandoned the baby, and the dad told the little boy that now this little baby panda bear was homeless, and he asked the question, as four-year-olds do, are people homeless? And that kind of got the parents in a discussion with this little boy about homeless people. So Austin didn't like that people were homeless, and that some people were hungry, so he put on his little cape, kind of like a superhero cape.
Okay.
And he launched his cape crusade. So he asked his mom and dad that he wanted his allowance and his money that they would spend on toys for him to go to making chicken sandwiches for the homeless.
How old is this kid?
4 years old.
Oh, that's amazing.
So now he goes around and he gives these sandwiches to homeless people and also tells them, don't forget to show love. So, you know, he said that, you know, this is what President Austin, which is what he calls himself, this is what he's doing. And maybe someday this little kid will be president because, you know, at 4 years old, he's got a big heart and some, you know, savvy to go out and help other people. So good for him to feed the homeless.
Well, that's a nice heartwarming story.
Anything
else?
Well, you know, I don't really have any more homeless, but I did notice, you know, I always like my little animal story. And this is kind of a happy one for me that even though I don't live anywhere near there, there's in South Africa, there's these black rhinos, and they really were put on the endangered list and basically almost extinct, right? And just recently, they have released some black rhinos back into the wild, some males and females. And the reason that we've lost them is due to poaching. So people,
rhino horns, rhino powder. It's a huge problem in Africa.
So in the last 7 years, the African parks have practically eliminated the poaching in some of the areas. So now that they've, even though it's still, you know, a threat, they have now been able to bring some of these six rhinos will breed, and hopefully they'll renew the rhino herd in Africa. And that's such good news because it would be such a shame to lose that species off the face of the planet.
You know, once they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, poaching in Africa is a huge, huge problem because they don't have enough conservation officers. And also, there's so much money in poaching, right, that they can kill these guys. You know, they can kill these conservation officers, and they're huge, huge areas of territory that they have to police. And so they not only use helicopters and airplanes, but now they're starting to use drones. But you're exactly right. And once the rhinos are gone, they'll never come back.
Well, let's hope that they breed and just renew the species. So I'm going to give you some more useless trivia tonight, honey.
You know, tonight is we've seen a lot of useless trivia, but you know what? I kind of like
very,
it.
I'm very good at that. So, okay, so do you want to know what some of the most popular things bought on Amazon were last month?
Yeah, I do want to know because I want to know if anything that I bought on Amazon is any of those things.
Well, let's see. You could have bought an antibacterial shower curtain liner.
No, because we have glass showers.
Okay.
Okay.
So, but that was one of the most popular things bought on Amazon. And this one is kind of interesting to me. Charcoal powder for your teeth.
Would it be black colored?
It is. And you know what? When I was in the store the other night with our daughter-in-law, she pointed that out. And she said, oh, should we buy some of this? I said, oh, no.
What does it take?
Apparently, it makes your teeth white and so forth.
Well,
I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
Isn't it black? Isn't
it
charcoal
is, but
black?
It doesn't make your teeth black. It makes your teeth white.
I think I'd like to talk to somebody that's been using it.
Okay, it's because it uses absorption to pull the stains off the teeth. That's the whole thing about the charcoal.
Okay,
so that was one of the most popular things bought on Amazon last week.
Okay.
A lot of things were personal things like body masks and creams and hair waxes and things for men.
Leaves me out.
Yeah, that does leave you out. a miracle product for clogged shower drains. Now,
oh, wait a minute. Now, can I hang on a second? Okay. Hang on. I see something for a guy. An easy-to-use knife sharpener.
Oh, gosh, you and your knife sharpeners.
I got a lot of knives. Replace your dull knife with one of the best chef's knives. I want you to – I'm going to Google this. I want you to get this for me. Okay. What else? Okay. What else are they? Well, what else are people buying?
Well, we have.
You got me going.
We've got. Maybe I shouldn't have done this for you. We've got meat thermometers, which we already have one of those, so we're okay. I would like this one, an aromatherapy diffuser. I would like that.
Well, I know that you and our daughter-in-law were at the soap store. Right? The other night, right?
Yes, we went out to bombs. Dinner. Yes,
okay.
Bath bombs.
And you bought a whole bag full of it.
But the things that I just thought were the interesting things that were so big on Amazon were the robot vacuum cleaners, right?
Our dog would kill it.
And you could
she'd
ride on it, I'm not sure.
She would
chase it. But you know, they you can control them by the Alexa now and Bluetooth, right? And I would never do that because that's how our technology spies on us.
That's right.
But
artificial
anyway,
intelligence, no, that's a no. Just cross that out.
The other thing that I just thought was really interesting, and I actually have never seen, is a toilet accessory that is a toilet bowl nightlight for your bathroom. It lights up the inside of your toilet, I guess, so that when you're stumbling in there at night
Well, that's more of a guy thing, right? Because, you know, can I share something with you?
Does this mean that the floors would be cleaner around?
Well, you know what? Okay, and I'm sure I'm not the only guy that thinks like this. When you go into like a public restroom and there's like pee all over the floor, and I'm saying like, come on, look how big the urinal is, and you guys are missing this? Are they all drunk or what?
I don't know.
Anyway.
I am not in that. But anyway, I just thought that was really an interesting thing that it got that many sales to be even on this list. So then there's some Instant Pot, kitchen gadgets, and so forth. But, you know, I would say a lot, if there's any one thing that people bought more of, it was personal things like the creams and the gels and the things for, you know, their hair and face and all that. But these couple of things I just thought were you'd get a kick out of. And then, of course, you know, one of my favorite gadgets is the long lightning cables for your, you know, charging your phones and things, so the very long cables. And I love my really long cable because when you're in a hotel,
the plug
is never long, you know, is never near you where you need it. So
we have one. You have one. I don't have one, but you have one that you like.
I may
put
have
together,
an extra one.
You know, where you put them together, where you put them together.
Yep.
So anyway, listen, before we kick it off for tonight, I want you to make a promise to me that you're going to get me a knife sharpener.
No, that is a promise I cannot guarantee that I would keep, but I will let you go wash those knives up and I'll go to bed.
Well, I'll get the dishes tonight and I'll meet you in bed.
Okay.
I love you.
Love you.